This is Comics Therapy, episode 42. No reviews, just analysis. Up this week, two comics from May 14th, 2014. All New X-Men number 27 and The Field number 2. As always, we have your nerd confessions, and on the couch, we welcome writer Joe Keating. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot, so consider this your spoiler warning.
Hey guys, James Kaplan here. In response to your question about favorite time travel story, my answer has to be Back to the Future. When Back to the Future came out, I was about 9 years old, and I'm pretty sure I saw it 4 times in the theater. Now, why it is that my parents let me go see it 4 times, or let me have the money to go see it 4 times, since I'm sure I didn't have any of my own money, is beyond me, but I'm not complaining because it's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's got action, humor, amazing humor, so many great jokes, jokes about the 50s, jokes about the 80s, it's got amazingly memorable characters, it's got weird Oedipal stuff, it's got, you know, more conventional romance. There's just so much that's good and great in that movie. And the time travel stuff, if you poke at it, like any time travel story, it's likely to fall apart a little bit if you kind of poke at it too much, but I think it holds up pretty well as far as a time travel story, and I think the movie is amazing. Just as a quick note, one of my favorite time travel comics is Pax Romana by Jonathan Hickman. It's a very Hickman book in the sense that it's chock full of charts and infographics and all that kind of visual information, which is really enjoyable. And it's a great story where, you know, a group of soldiers go back in time to change history, and you get to see the results unfold over time. Anyway, just wanted to mention that. Thanks for doing a great show.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. This week's theme is time travel, because why the fuck not? It's probably the most common theoretical exercise, right? It's a daydream that starts at a young age and gets more and more complicated as you're exposed to the rules and parameters of countless stories, movies, television shows, and comics that use traveling through time as a catalyst, solution, or problem to be solved.
In between comic segments, your very own nerd confessions, answering life's deepest geeky questions, and celebrating what we love and what we snark about comics. This week, we asked for some of your favorite time travel tales in any medium. You can call, Skype, or email your confessions to us. The details are on the website, comicstherapy.com. Remember, catharsis is cool.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter, at Andrea Schock, and Aaron, at Aaron Myers. The show account is at Comics Therapy. So, Aaron, talk to me about time travel. What's your favorite?
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
That's the one with the whales, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been way overplayed, but when I saw that in the theater as a kid,
Yeah. That
was awesome.
Yeah?
Slingshot around the sun, go back in time. 80s, you know, on the Spock pinching a guy's neck, a punk's neck on the bus.
Right.
And it was all in San Francisco.
Yeah.
You know, being a Northern California person growing up, we kind of, you know, San Francisco is a special place to me. I don't know if you know about San Francisco at all.
No, not a damn thing.
No. So, yeah, that's the one that comes to mind first. I mean, there's a ton of time travel stuff. Either that, I'll say it's a tie between that and Quantum Leap.
Okay, wow, I didn't think about Quantum Leap.
Yeah, that's probably my favorite TV show.
Yeah, man. USA used to run the repeats of that. I think, gosh, was I in college? Whenever it would have been in syndication, like, the first time. Maybe high school. And we would just marathon that. Oh, that was a great show. So mine is Back to the Future. And it's the only thing that I thought of immediately. For the same nostalgia factor as you, I mean, it's the first time I was exposed to the concept of time travel. And so the memory of sitting in the theater as a kid and watching that and getting it. And it's probably one of the first, like, real science fiction stories that I, like, grasped.
Oh, okay.
And I can still quote large passages from that movie. And last summer when it was re-released, I took Avi to see it, kind of in the same hope that it would be this, I don't know, like, a moment for him to see how time travel could be like a really fun concept.
Probably didn't have the same effect on him.
He did okay. He did okay. Mm-hmm.
I always have the feeling that if we're super excited about something, our kids probably won't be.
Well, it wasn't so much that he wasn't excited about it. That was a slightly more sophisticated movie than he had seen. I know, like he has trouble. He's much better now. This past year has been like a big leap forward for media consumption for him. But at that point, going to a movie theater and watching a movie hadn't really happened. Mm. And it was his choice, not mine. So sitting down to watch a live action movie that was dealing with like some pretty serious topics. And there are a couple of moments in there that I know went way over his head, but that are definitely PG.
Well, I'd say incest might be a little bit like PG-13.
Not even that. That's going to go over most kids' heads until they're much older and they can be like, wait, holy shit, that was his mom. I mean, like the scene in the car with Biff, like that he could tell was a source of agitation and disruption and like, you know, heading towards assault. Right. But like the ramifications of that, it's not really going to be felt until much, much later also. Anyway,
right.
That wasn't the issue. He was, I think I told you this after he saw it, he was so concerned. The way that the movie ends when Doc comes back and he's like, oh man, Marty, it's not you. It's your kids. We got to do something about your kids. And they have to like go back again. Well, they go forward, right? Avi burst into tears. He was so concerned after all of that trauma of like one thing after another and finally getting Marty back to the present. He just kept saying, why do they have to go back? Why? Why do they have to go again? They just got there. Can't they stay? So that's actually what started our whole conversation with him about like processing conflict in stories and like rising action as a storytelling device is a good thing, kiddo. It's not a bad thing.
Right, right.
But yeah, I mean, Back to the Future, number one movie, absolutely. But then I wrote down two stories that I wanted to mention just in case anybody hasn't read them before. Time and Again by Jack Finney, which I read ages ago. It's prose. And I think the reason why it's...
Well, who does art?
What?
Who does the art?
It's prose, dumbass. It's a book.
What's that?
Huh? It's a book. Actually, there's quite a bit of... there are a bunch of illustrations from the 19th century in the book, as a matter of fact. Here's why, actually. You're being a smartass, but like, here's why that's a relevant point. The premise for the time travel is, and this is why I always thought it was kind of kick-ass as a scenic designer, they basically create an environment, like, authentically, and sort of, like, hypnotize themselves into magicking back to like old-timey times. Basically, if they can be in costume and create this physical space from the, I think it's the 1880s in New York City, then they whoosh magic back to that. And it was sort of silly premise when you have to explain it, but it's a really intriguing development. Like there's some I think there's a government office involved with developing the technology and the kind of soft science around it. I always thought it was cool. The other one is Go Toward the Light by Harlan Ellison, which is a short story in Slippage. And I fucking love Harlan Ellison. If you've never read Slippage or Angry Candy, those are the two collections of his short stories. And I think they're awesome. But the reason why Go Toward the Light as a time travel story is notable is that it takes this idea of a very like practical origin for essentially like a supernatural event. And I always thought that really stuck with me as like an explanation for something after the fact that we see as kind of mystical, but it looks at the kind of accidental, very, very reasonable start for that event as a kind of accidental side effect of the time travel.
Can I give two suggestions then?
Yeah, there's no rules. What, do you think this is like...
Where we're going, there are no rules?
Nice. There's no rules. Go for it.
H.G. Wells, The Time Machine?
Sure.
Which is actually a really good time travel story.
Yeah. Go figure.
Like, it holds up, you know, even though it's like kind of the original one. It's good. Yeah. Now, my second one would be The Restaurant at the End of the Universe.
Oh, of course.
That's a classic time travel story.
Sure. Douglas Adams. Right? So great.
Yeah, it counts.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm very welcoming to all different types of time travel.
Good. You're open to all types of time travel lifestyles?
I am. As we get into...
That's very progressive
yes,
of you.
Yes, thank you. As we get into talking about all new X-Men, though, there still have to be rules. But, I mean, just, like, look at Time and Again. I just described it as being kind of goofy, all things considered. The method of actually traveling through time is a little bit silly. But I'm fine with it as long as it's clearly presented and it's consistent.
Well, you want to talk about our first book then?
Yes. Oh, I just thought of another one. Man, Cowboy Fang by Stephen Brust. Gosh, that's such a good book. Man, I've been reading like books. You should go and find it. I've been reading prose recently to fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
Without pictures.
Yeah, books put me to sleep, yeah.
Right. And I gotta add that to my pile. I could reread that one at any point. Okay, anyway. First book.
This is the phone number that I called to talk about time travel. This is Christopher Sabella calling. And I just want to talk about Quantum Leap and how amazing Quantum Leap is. I don't know what I'm supposed to say after that. Except Quantum Leap is really great. And probably my favorite time travel thing ever. And if anyone listening to this knows who holds the rights to publishing Quantum Leap as a comic book, please tell them to get in touch with me because I will write that for free. Until I die. Alright. I also like Back to the Future. But 1 and 2, I don't like 3 though. Hope that helps. Bye!
Our first book this week is All New X-Men number 27, written by Brian Michael Bendis, with pencils by Stuart Immonen, inks by Wade Von Graubadger, and colors by Marte Garcia, and lettering by Corey Pettit. There we go. All New X-Men is published by Marvel Comics.
Okay, I didn't do anything to prepare for either of these.
Well, the X-Men, the original X-Men, Silver Age X-Men, are here in the present, and that's been going on now for a couple of years.
Yeah.
So we just got done with the Battle of the Atom event, which was sort of the fight between the X-Men and the Avengers and debating about how and when and why the original X-Men should be sent back to their time.
Right.
Which ended up that they would not be going back.
Yep.
And then we had the trial of Jean Grey.
Yep.
Shortly thereafter, which now is over, and Cyclops is no longer on Earth. He's pirating with his dad.
It just sounds stupider and stupider the more you. That's yeah.
No, X-Men continuity is very rich and complicated.
So fucked up.
So right now we find ourselves with the future X-Men. Kind of evil, Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, but...
Future style.
Whatever. Yeah. Come back to the present to finish the job they tried to do a short time ago.
Yeah.
So we're kind of a mid-event in this, but overall, like, I've been reading this series. I picked it up late. Like, I kind of didn't pay attention to it for, like, the first 10 issues, mm-hmm. and then I had to catch back up.
That's interesting, because I read the first 10 issues and was like, okay, I'm done. And took a break, and then skipped a bunch in the middle, and then started reading it again, because I find it tedious.
Yeah, but do you find, like, do you get kind of burnt out on most X-Men stuff?
I don't think burnt out is the right word, but I definitely think that there is more effort involved for me to enjoy the way that these stories have developed over the past couple of years than the other main titles in the Marvel line. And that's across the board with the X-Men titles. That's including Brian Wood's X-Men. That's including even, well, I mean, even the storyline in Uncanny Avengers, that basically everything that has come as a consequence of AVX, including Consequences, which actually was a really solid kind of miniseries to cap that event off, I've been less excited by.
I go in waves. I've been riding a high, like a manic high, on X-Men stuff now for like a year.
Okay, why?
I don't know. It's just, I think I had taken a break from it for long enough that now, once it hooked me back in, I've been excited to read and follow the different storylines kind of crisscrossing each other.
Do you find that time travel in big two stories, and I guess when I say big two, everybody knows by now that I'm almost exclusively talking about Marvel. Do you feel that it's more of a cop-out than when it's used in a standalone, like creator-owned or independent title?
Really depends. So, like, besides how it ended, I really liked Age of Ultron a ton.
Okay.
You know, and the ending, I didn't hate. It's just, you know, it wasn't the ending I was hoping for.
Right.
But it's fine. As events go, like, I've read worse. But I really like the event overall. And that's a time travel. That's time travel, altered history, you know.
I guess I'd put that more in the altered history kind of what if category than a strict time travel story. But at this point, and it is so convoluted by its very nature that there's like no mystique involved anymore. It's always available to solve the problem. We joke about how it's always available to solve the problem. We can always restart back to where we needed to undo anything. And so that speaks to the rules, the parameters of time travel that like have to be consistent in order for it to work as a standalone story. But as a device in the Marvel universe, it is all powerful. And so it just basically ends up being a fun theoretical exercise. Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that the story is bad. It's just that the story has no standing consequences. But that's sort of a product of a Marvel universe story anyway.
Yeah, I guess so. I would argue that Marvel has taken time travel, you know, starting, let's say, starting with the beginning of this series and including Age of Ultron.
Okay.
Having serious changes to the Marvel Universe. Because this hasn't, you know, they haven't reset it. It wasn't kind of standalone, encompassed, like, oh, they go back and everything's fine.
Yes.
I think the rules have been established at this point, at least within Marvel. And that's the current rules. Obviously, everything changes but and can be reset. But that's the nature of, you know, of Marvel and DC Comics.
No kidding.
That there were serious ramifications from Age of Ultron that fractured the universe and changed things. And, you know, especially if you were keeping up with the Ultimates line, like that Age of Ultron broke the Ultimate universe, which was beneficial to them because it needed to be reset anyway. But because, you know, Galactus got sucked in and destroyed the world. And then that brought Angela
That wasn't in Age of Ultron.
Yeah, because of Age of Ultron, Galactus was sucked into the Ultimate Universe.
That was in Battle of the Atom.
No, that had nothing to do with Battle of the Atom.
What was the event right after Age of Ultron?
Well, there was the, I don't know, there's always like three or four events
going on. And I'm so bad with names.
There was the whole Ultimate, like, Cataclysm.
Maybe I'm just thinking of Cataclysm.
Yeah, so like, because Galactus got sucked out of the 616 universe.
It all comes as a result of... Yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah, and Angela's brought in from the Image universe.
Oh!
into...
Angela, do you mean Thor's sister?
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
You didn't know that?
No, did you?
Yeah, I just actually was rereading Spawn number 9, and it pretty clearly lays that out.
You're kidding, right?
Yes, of course.
That would be awesome, though.
It would be. That would be a time travel
you
thing.
You should perpetuate that and just be like, no, 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 guys, go back. Go read Spawn 9 or like just pick some fucking random number or change it every time you reference it. Oh, no, no, sure. It's in Spawn 13. Go ahead.
Oh, you have to say it with an authoritative nerd voice. Well, actually, if you look back in Spawn number 9 and 10, it's pretty clear what Gaiman was planning from the whole get-go in the 90s. He knew this was going to happen.
You
so,
do that
yeah, it's there.
Very well.
It's in the blood. Anyway.
Okay, anyway.
So, are we talking about X-Men still?
We can
or are we
talk
just
about X-Men still.
I don't care.
I don't dislike the story. I will admit that it makes my head hurt. And actually, I wrote down this quote because it's from 25. And Jean says to now Scott, every time I think about what we're doing to space and time, my head hurts. Like, fucking yes. I totally agree. My head hurts thinking about the rules and the lack thereof. And that's ultimately what I get a little frustrated with. That's all.
I think it also kind of speaks to the type of brains that we have, you and I.
I think too much and it's super obnoxious.
I think I mind map differently than you, though. Like, I kind of have that mental threads, like, this one connects to this one, but it connects to this one sort of, except for this writer isn't really remembering that, so it doesn't quite work.
Right.
And, you know, that's part of the fun of, that's why I like continuity. And I think you don't like continuity.
No, I wouldn't say that I don't like continuity. In fact,
we can't talk about continuity too much, though, because people have yelled at us.
True.
So I'm just giving you that warning.
But.
Or I'll have to go back in time and delete all this.
That's what editing is all about, man.
Is editing time travel?
Kind of, a little bit. Certainly the only kind I know how to do.
Mind blown.
Yep. There you go. So I think that I look at continuity as the structure that allows me to suspend disbelief.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain flexibility in the continuity that I'm willing to accept. But if all of the rules get broken, then I accept it as something that exists outside of continuity, and then I appreciate it as a standalone story. Like a what-if kind of theoretical exercise, just like I would with any other story. But when it tries to be both, that's when I pick up an issue and I have to work too hard to figure out who is who and why and where, and that is not fun for me as a reader.
I totally understand that, and I think that's why publishers are constantly resetting at number ones now, because they don't want people to have to think about that it would. I think that's more fun when you're a kid.
Is it?
Especially,
'cause I remember that feeling too when I started reading comics a million years ago.
Well, that was part of the fun for me, is like, especially since I got issues sporadically.
Different brains, dude.
Yeah, I guess so, because I'd like have to like try to figure out or fill in storylines, because I'd be missing three or four issues, to try to keep track of like what was going on. You know, it's almost like having 75 out of 100 pieces of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm. And I get that, and I've certainly read longer runs of mostly older things in that way. Sometimes you can skip ahead, sometimes you have to skip ahead, whatever. But I read a lot of comics, and at this point, if I get to a story and I'm like, what are we doing now? Slow down. What the fuck? Then, I don't know, maybe that's not 100% my fault. That's all I'm saying.
No, I agree. I think the average reader doesn't read as many comics as we might as well, you know?
That was nice of you to put us in that same category.
Well, I was being generous. Yeah. So, say we're reading 40 issues a week. I don't even try to remember before I start reading what's going on in the storyline. It kind of comes back to me as I'm reading. Mm-hmm. I guess that's like how my brain's adapted to it.
I have a question for you about... I don't know how to put this. Were you into sports cards before you were into, like, magic or anything like that?
Oh, yeah.
So, do you remember statistics? Do you
I don't. I'm not that on that part of the spectrum.
It's not a spectrum-y thing. It's just a... I'm trying to think of an analogy that isn't sports-related, because for me, the...
Yeah, I'm not a stats and numbers kind of person. My brain is not very mathematical in that way.
Right, but, like, the other example that I would have given is... I have so many friends that can describe the play that happened during the last 2 minutes of the game and, like, who passed to whom and who scored and...
Nope.
All of that way of processing, like, visual information with the, like, specifics of the names and numbers and times and things that I just don't capture, like, experiences.
No,
that
that's a weakness in my memory. Like, I can, it's more esoteric than that. Like, I can never remember details. Like, very rarely.
So,
like, even, like, part of it's anxiety and part of it's, like, just my brain is not formed right that way or something.
Do you think you're more forgiving then when it is a really convoluted story? Like a huge Marvel event with time travel over multiple years. And at this point, all new X-Men is, it's not new reader friendly at all. Nobody could pick up, even, what was it, 25, that did the kind of look back bullshit thing with the Watcher, or mm-hmm. a couple issues before that, when the new Point One. Give me a break. Mm-hmm. That's not a starting point for anybody to really understand, like, all of the moving parts of the story. Do you think you're more forgiving, though, because you don't remember the moving parts?
Maybe. What I'm saying, though, is I remember the moving parts as I'm reading the issue, and then as soon as I'm done with the issue and I've had the experience, I move on to the next issue.
Okay.
Like, they don't really stick with me until I'm back in it again.
You don't overthink and obsess and think again and obsess again and mull it over in your head for the next couple of...
Not unless, unless something comes up that really bothers me. Like, something that breaks the story. Mm. In my opinion, then, you know, I wouldn't say I'd obsess, but I might be upset about it.
Okay.
Like, this took me out of it. This like, you know, this issue didn't work.
Okay.
So
it's more of a negative.
What's going on with her? Yeah. If it's a good thing, then it's like, I've read it. I close it up, put it in its bag, seal it up with tape, and move on to the next one. Like I do with everything in my life.
Carefully categorized and then compartmentalized and filed mm-hmm. away your life experiences.
Yep. And then if I would like to briefly relive them, I can take them out of their long box, unpack them, read them again, and put them away again.
Got it.
Mm-hmm. It's good kind of having a goldfish memory in that way.
It's so funny because I describe my memory the same way, but in a obviously very, very different result.
Yep.
Yeah.
I would say the effects stick with you. It all... washes off my back like I'm a duck, right?
That's
almost how the saying goes.
Nope, not even a little bit. But it's a cute little visual.
Like ducks off a dog's back.
Is that a thing?
No. You want
to
talk about some more comics?
I'm trying to think if I had anything else to say about all new X-Men.
Let me check. Hang on, I'm gonna go to the future. You don't.
Oh no, I do. It's just not relevant to time travel. I was excited that Laura pops up in this story because after Avengers Arena, you know, she's pretty fucked up. And so, like, seeing X-23 as a character was an exciting thing because I really liked that book quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't think she's any worse than she has been in the past.
What do you mean?
Like, she's never been, like, content, happy, and, you know, and at peace, and then suddenly Avengers Arena happens.
No, but there's definitely a lot of reference to the fact that she, like, went through the worst experience of her life.
Sure. I don't know.
And it just, like, because she's not in Avengers Undercover.
See, I'd say the Weapon X program was worse.
Well, yeah, that was pretty shitty.
So, you know, she's had a lot of rough things happen to her.
She has. Oh, see, I do have love for the X-Men stories and all of their many, many, many derivations mm-hmm. and the characters. And it's just that sometimes it seems a little bit too much like work.
Yeah, I'd say so. And that's...
If I could stop time...
It's take it or leave it, though.
If I could stop time mm-hmm. and just read them, then I would be fine. But that's not the same as time travel.
That's not the fault of the publisher to create a rich and diverse universe that you could you can choose to immerse yourself into.
Oh, God forbid I complain that something takes too much effort to enjoy as opposed to something being oversimplified.
Right, exactly.
Okay, moving on.
All right.
Hello, this is Captain Cummings, and you can find me on YouTube by searching Captain Cummings. You can also find me on Twitter via Mystery Vlog. That's a V, not a B. Now, after the branding, I will go to the question of the week, which is, we like time travel. Do you like time travel? Tell us about your favorite. Well, my favorite, as no surprise, is an Avengers book. To be specific, Avengers number 56, which has Captain America standing over a dead Bucky. Now, this book is a time travel issue where Cap goes back in time using Dr. Doom's time machine. But in this time travel story, he cannot affect what's in the past like other stories, and it's real interesting to watch him see this terrible event go on, but not be able to do it. And it's quite touching in my opinion, and is very fun to read and take in.
Our second book is The Field Number 2, written and lettered by Ed Brisson, Simon Roy on art, and Simon on the coloring. One of those two. The Field is published by Image Comics.
Yep.
So we're only two issues in.
Yeah, but it's still, it's just a four-issue miniseries.
Right.
So it's okay to talk about.
Okay.
It's also a very dramatically different concept of time travel.
Possibly.
Yeah? Why not?
I don't know. I don't, like, at two issues, I think there's enough to talk and speculate about. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what we're dealing with.
Okay, so let me make the distinction that primarily we have a narrator who doesn't know what the hell's going on. And we don't have a trustworthy ally for said narrator to explain anything. We're figuring things out the same time he is, or... Mm-hmm. Around the same time, which is a very different storytelling device than in X-Men. Yeah?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with
that. Okay, so I guess that's what I mean about it being very dramatically different. Whether the science is that different or not.
Or if it's even a time travel story.
Yeah, I guess. Sure. The point at which it's revealed to be time travel, we have no reason to trust that informant more than some of the others. Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. So, you know, this could be a mind reality kind of story or something,
yeah.
You know.
Sure.
But whatever.
I think what I told you, it reminded me of a little bit of like Groundhog Day. In a
yes.
Like super
with a lot more headshots.
Very twisted. Lots more violence, but the sense that he had been there before and that things continue to happen in much the same way. And
there are some aspects of Groundhog's Day I don't think I'd show kids, now that I think about it.
I haven't seen that in a long time, but...
Like, he kills himself several times,
yeah.
robs banks.
Not the happiest story.
No, there's like a lot of stuff now that I think about it. It's like, I don't know if I, like, I was thinking like, oh, when can we watch that with Luke? And like, probably not for like a long time.
No, I don't think so.
You know, we should just, I wish I was more like my parents, you know, kind of ignorant to media in a way. And you just go. You go to a movie or you just put it on and it's like, you just watch Labyrinth and can't sleep that
night.
But
so much of that has to do with the personality of the kid. Right? Like, I've shown Avi things that were not appropriate. And it's not like he just rose to the occasion. His particular personality did not mesh with my overzealousness. And the results, while not catastrophic, were, like, not exactly what I wanted. Totally turned him off to Indiana Jones
oh my
earlier
God.
Than I should have.
Whoa.
What?
Like, original? Like, Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Temple of Doom?
Oh, that's even worse.
See, I debated. I was thinking the Temple of Doom would be better.
He rips his still beating heart out of his chest.
Yep, shortly after that is when we took a break.
And there's, like, the whole, like, scene, like, oh my god, there's a ton of stuff in there that is terrifying.
Well, except that he loved the Goonies. And we've watched that multiple times since. So
yeah, I wonder.
I don't think that they're. I'm not saying that they're the same, but I think that there is a relationship between the two that I thought he was okay with. I don't know.
Yeah, Temple of Doom definitely has a lot more graphic, scary stuff.
Plus, that, all the stuff with the kids, and like that's part of it is that it involves the kids.
Mm-hmm. Like Goonies. Like, the things that are scary visually turn out to be kind of good, you know?
Well, everybody is already dead. Nobody dies. Even the bad guys don't die.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So.
Exactly.
I think that that's also a difference. But you're right. Groundhog Day is.
I think, personally, I think our kids would probably be bored through most of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an adult movie.
Okay. I don't know what it's like, rated, so I don't have any sense of
I mean,
that.
It's probably rated PG or PG-13, yeah. But it's not something, like, kids were going to be into.
Okay.
So, what are we talking about?
Time travel?
Comics? I love the concepts brought in this. I love that fast pace of you're just being sucked along.
With no exposition?
Yeah, I kind of like that, where you get the tiny little nuggets of reveal, or maybe not, like, especially in a short series.
It's quite a departure from Bendis, that's for damn sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not long format, either.
No, but...
You know, it's compressed, like, we're going to find out in two more issues everything that's going on and have a resolution of some sort. Mm-hmm. Or will we?
I'm glad you did that, because I was tempted to, but it sounded dumb, so it was you who did it.
Yeah, that's me.
Yep. Do you
like ambiguous endings, actually? Sometimes?
Sometimes, sure. I think that I've become more forgiving of ambiguous endings. I'm trying to think of like Inception? Totally fine with that ending being ambiguous.
Yep. Okay.
But other times, if I think that the resolution is just not being dealt with out of... I don't know. I have to buy into it. I have to... Even something that is not spelled out still has to be done well.
You know what we forgot to suggest?
What?
That is maybe my favorite time travel movie.
What?
Primer?
I don't know that.
Oh my god. You gotta watch Primer.
Oh, okay. What is it?
Everyone has to go watch Primer.
Okay.
It is a fairly low-budget movie. The Upstream Color. Do you know that movie? Mm-hmm. It's recent. That's his second movie.
Okay.
Oh, everyone should watch both of those.
Okay. Who is it?
But I don't remember. We just talked about me not remembering names.
Right.
I was able to pull the names of two movies. That's a minor miracle.
Well, even if you remembered the name, you would pronounce it wrong, so it's fine.
Probably. So Primer, and then Upstream Color is not a time travel movie, but it is an amazing movie.
Okay, but what is so good about Primer?
It's just a very well done kind of practical time travel movie that requires multiple viewings.
2004? Man, it's not that old.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not that old. It's a very successful independent movie. I think it had a very small budget.
Holy
but
shit,
you wouldn't know
$7,000.
Yeah, I mean, it was shot on, like, handycams,
that's
but
awesome.
It doesn't matter. It's the story. It has no need for special effects.
Yeah. That's great.
And it is probably the best time travel movie I've ever seen.
Okay, cool. I'm in.
I think there's the aspects of the field that kind of triggered that for me.
That's why I just thought of it. Because we don't have all of the information? Is it?
We don't have all the information. It's kind of revealed in layers.
Okay.
It's hard. I mean, it's very hard to explain.
So is the field.
Exactly.
Have you noticed that we haven't actually talked about it?
There's not much to talk about other than it's a possible time travel story with a character who has no idea what's going on other than he's the center of something. and they're running from people that he maybe should be running from, or maybe not should not be running from.
Yeah. I think the device of the text messages is just enough of like omniscient awareness to keep me pulled into the story. I think that's super cool.
Mm-hmm.
Like puppet master style communication.
Mm-hmm.
Is sometimes
that there's a very fine line to run with that, though, where I get annoyed with stories that rely on that too heavily, where information isn't revealed without reason for it not being revealed.
Got it. But I think, you know what I mean? One of the things that right off the bat happens is that, right, the first text he gets is, don't get in the car, and he gets in the car.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm cool
with that. No, I'm not saying this story suffers from that. Mm-hmm. Yet. I'm just saying there are a lot of stories that do that sort of, like, you know, look to your right, or, you know, in 5 minutes, so-and-so is going to happen. You got 5 minutes. Tell me what's going on.
Well, presumably. Again, we don't actually have any reason to believe that any of the people are telling the truth, but the texter himself seems not to have survived the most recent encounter with the crazy guy the source is palling around with.
Mm-hmm.
So
we'll see. So what we'll do is, after we read the next two, mm-hmm. we will go back and add, you know, in time and add on to this discussion.
Shit, did you just give me more editing to do?
Yeah, but it's in the future.
Oh, that's fine.
Future editing.
No problem.
Right?
Yeah, it's all good.
Mm-hmm. Talking about future editing, because I don't think you've edited yet.
Oh my gosh, there's so much editing to do with our forever long conversation with Joe Keating, but... if you're listening to this now, that means that I actually accomplished it.
And it was... let's make it sound a little better than that, because it was forever long, because we had a really good discussion.
Oh, yeah. I accomplished making our forever long conversation into something masterful for you all to enjoy.
Yes. So, why don't you go and do that now?
That was... yeah.
It was okay.
That was fine.
It's like a 6 out of 10.
Very well.
I've done worse.
Yeah, every week it's a new challenge, so.
It is.
Awesome.
All right, everyone, enjoy this discussion with Jill Keating.
On the couch, we're hanging out with Eisner and Harvey winner Joe Keating. Joe's been an editor, writer, artist, colorist, publicist. Over the years, he's worn a lot of hats, and he's not that old. These days, he's probably best known for his work with Marvel Comics and Image Comics, including his new creator-owned series, Shudder, with Layla Del Duca. And if my Twitter feed is any indication, a lot of people are also talking about his What If? Age of Ultron, published by Marvel. He's got a lot of other irons in the fire. We'll get to those in a second. Thanks for talking with us, Joe.
So maybe at the top of the show, you can kind of give us a rundown of what's recently out and what you've got coming out, if there's anything to announce that people should be aware of.
Yeah, sure. No, yeah. Like saying that I'm in an interesting place because, like, last year, or excuse me, a few months ago, everything that I had, like, in the works was announced, and I was like, awesome, I don't have to, like, worry about, like, slipping at all, you know? and then that's now drastically changed. But
does that mean things fell through, or that you just find yourself, now you have to plan for the rest of the year?
No. I mean...
now you just have more.
Neither. There's a lot more stuff coming out that I'm not supposed to mention at all, so that's cool. But the stuff that is out that I'm really excited about, I mean, the big thing is Shudder, which is the book that we... Layla and I announced at Image Expo this year, and now it's finally like a real thing. There's already one issue out, another one on the way, and
yep. By the time this comes out, the second issue will have come out this week.
Oh right. Yeah, that's true, and I've seen it, so you know it's coming.
Yeah,
it's printed. But the What If Age of Ultron thing just wrapped up, and then I did like a Superman thing for DC that's being collected.
And Tech Jacket's been announced.
Well, and then that's the next thing after that, yeah. Or I guess right before the Superman thing is the I'm doing an ongoing Tech Jacket series with Kari Randolph through Skybound.
Which is also, it's both digital and printed now, right?
Yeah, well, before there was like a 3-issue digital-only miniseries that's now being collected in trade paperback in July.
Yep.
But yeah, this is like, you know, same day, single issue, print, digital, whatever you want, basically.
Right.
But if there's a way that they can publish it, you can download it.
So was that 3-issue digital only? Was that sort of testing the waters for the market for Tech Jacket?
You'd really have to ask Robert Kirkman and Sean Mackowitz that question. I've known Robert for a really long time, both mm-hmm. as like a friend and colleague, and I remember just a few years ago I was asking him what the deal with Tech Jacket was, like, yeah, we're gonna bring it back or whatever. Not in terms of like, hey, hire me to write it, because uh-huh. I'm curious, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then he hit me up. It was like, hey man, I got this idea to do like the Netflix ish model for comics and see how that would work.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
Because everything was released like immediately. Like the whole series, all 3 issues were available like right off the bat.
It was announced at Image Expo, and as soon as it was announced, it was on the Image website, and you could download all 3
right.
issues. Yeah.
Right.
And I guess it did really well. So they were like, hey, let's do some more of this. And I was like, as long as Kari's on board, I'm on board. Kari cool. Randolph is the artist and this guy who I really want to work with forever, and he's awesome to work with. So I was like, all right, yeah, as long as he's in, I'm in. And he was, so yeah, that's what we're, so now it's like an ongoing thing, you know?
Cool.
Yeah.
But wait, when you say ongoing, sorry, just because I think that's what you were starting to say before, and I was thinking ongoing like a standard series, but you're saying you're going to do this little mini Netflix model ongoing?
No, now we're actually are ongoing. Okay. That was just for the initial 3-issue thing we did. That's
sure.
Yeah, so now this is like a regular released once a month.
Like the old school series. Way that people
yeah.
read the comics.
Yeah, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the Battlestar Galactica of comic books, because you had the miniseries first, and now you got the regular monthly series. Doesn't quite work because it's not weekly.
Yeah, no, but it's...
But nothing else that you can talk about, I guess.
There's stuff that, yeah, there's lots of stuff. But there's,
that's cool.
That's the stuff that's real and out now. You know,
right.
Or coming soon anyway, the stuff that people know about. Yeah.
Okay, well, we have to talk more about Shudder, obviously, and
please.
Congratulations to both of you on a solid debut with the first issue last month, and like
well,
we said
you.
Issue 2 is out this week. What's mm-hmm. been different in your approach to this process from your last creator-owned project, Hell Yeah?
I have a lot more experience now in terms of being a writer, like, you know, in terms of putting these things together, and, you know, really, I mean, I worked at Image for a really long time, but there's such a huge difference between, at least I found anyway, between, you know, working behind the scenes and actually having to do it from the creator point of view.
Right, right. So, we're going to actually talk about that in a bit also.
Oh, great. but I mean, like with, you know, Hell Yeah, it got ran pretty late and some real life stuff happened with Andre, and, you know, you know, it's whatever. So with Shudder, before I even announced it, I wanted to have a ton in the can. So I think, this is why I wish I was doing this with Layla, because she remembers this better than I do. But I think we have like 5 issues in the can at Image Expo when it was announced.
Oh, okay. So you're way ahead then.
And then so I'm revising issue 7, and I'm writing issue 8 right now. And she's midway or most of the way through 6, actually. And so, you know, number 2 is coming out this week. So, yeah. And so in terms of approaching, I mean, I don't know, you know, life is, you know, it's been a few years now. And so certain things change. And, you know, with Hell Yeah, I think a lot of it in terms of what I wanted to do with the book was like, I want to write a 90s Image comic.
Right.
So I wrote a 90s Image comic. And now I'm like, all right, well, that's out of my system. I just want to write my own stuff. You know what I mean?
Do you feel like... I guess less ownership in a way from Hell Yeah, just because you have that connection to the 90s Image stuff. And this truly is, I've heard you say that more than once, that this really feels like yours from the get-go in a slightly different way.
I don't know that I would say it's less ownership. I mean, you know, Andre and I created this thing together for the Hell Yeah, but this is definitely like, I was trying to go for a specific kind of thing. that was, I don't know if nostalgia base is the right thing, but it certainly was like indicative of an era of what I was reading. And obviously, you know, like anything, there's inspirations with it, but Shudder is, yeah, it's kind of more holy R thing, you know, just in the sense of, you know, we're not trying to do our pastiche and something else. I mean, a lot of the marketing has like, oh, Indiana Jones for the 21st century or whatever. But
sure, but marketing, you know, needs to compare to something. So
yeah, you know, I mean, I just never think of it that way. I never think of like, I want to do a 90s whatever. I just think of it like, we want to do our, this is the comic or one of the comics, I should say, because I don't want to, you know, I'm very, very proud of Hell Yeah and I'm working with Andre and everything that the book was. So I don't want to be like, you know, I don't want to seem like I'm downplaying it at all, because I'm really happy with what we did there. But this is, I guess, more so, if Hell Yeah, I was looking into what got me into wanting to make my own comics, Shudder is kind of looking into the future and seeing where I want things to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So,
yeah. No, I think that there's a way to talk about your evolution as a creator that, and I don't mean to downplay it either. I think there's a tremendous amount of love for Hell Yeah.
Thanks.
A lot of readers. Mm-hmm. And that can be totally separate and equal with love for Shudder and your other your other projects. But I think that there's no doubt that the growth as a writer is gonna kind of naturally happen with every new creator owned project that you're tackling.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, what, geez, the Hell Yeah outline I came up with in my earlier 20s, and then it came out, it was published, gosh, you guys probably know better than I do, I think it was published in early 2012.
Yeah, I think that's about right.
You know, and so I started writing Shudder scripts earlier last year. So, you know, things, just life got, I mean, a lot of life stuff happened, a lot of whatever. I mean, you know, hopefully the idea is you learn from each thing that you do, and you know, it gets better and better and better. And since there wasn't the, you know, sort of, I guess nostalgia is the right term, but nostalgia factor with Shudder, I don't know, it's just exciting. I get to do whatever I want with this partner who's, her artwork, I mean, Layla's artwork is just, she can just draw anything, you know? And when I asked her, and I hope I'm not ruining your interview narrative here by skipping ahead to her, she and I working together, but when I asked her, you know, what, because anytime I work on a project, whether it's creator-owned, Marvel, whatever, I always ask, like, hey, what do you want to draw? Like, that's the thing, because it's like, if you just hand over someone a script and expect them to get your brilliant work out there, it's like, ah, screw you, just write a book. You know what I mean? So I, like, you know, she's my partner, and so I was like, well, what do you want to draw? She was like, anything, but not like in the way of like whatever, but like, I like draw everything. So it's this continual challenge and of like, a measure, like, hopefully you're beginning to do her artwork justice, but also just like, you know, giving her stuff that she's going to enjoy drawing and have a blast doing. So far, so good.
Do you, and this is a hard question to articulate, but I like to ask writers this, you know, it's the work for hire versus the creator owned and the collaborative process. You know, it's sort of like the difference between getting to pick your baseball team and getting put on a baseball team.
Sure.
And I think there's benefits, at least from the reader side, I see benefits to both. But have you found that too? Is that part of like kind of your the evolution, say, over the next 5 years? You know, working on a lot of work for hire stuff too that you're put together with someone.
Yeah.
You know, which comes with its own challenges because it's not a relationship that's grown out of something. It's a, hey, you two work together. Kind of thing.
That's a really interesting way to look at it, actually. So great question. Yeah, I mean, it is different, you know, and like you know, when you work with, say, like at Marvel, right? Just using, because I have the most experience with them. I haven't really done a ton at DC, but with Marvel, you know, they have. I mean, actually, both companies now, with, you know, DC restructured under Warner, and they're really making an aggressive push in the multimedia, and then with Marvel, you know, being bought out by Disney,
right?
There's certain considerations there that weren't as dramatic as before in terms of like working with other media or what have you. So, you know, they have their set things that they want. Like, for instance, you know, my initial pitch for outline for Morbius was like really different from what the book was. I had,
oh really?
I don't want to get into it too much just because, you know,
sure.
You know, who knows what'll happen with those ideas, but played up more with the, I mean, and the monster stuff and whatever. and had it more of a sort of international focus. And then they were like, oh, no, we want them, like, you know, kind of in Brooklyn and have more street level stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. Like,
interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So I was like, all right, well, like, let's do it. So that's what it ended up sort of becoming. Whereas if it was a creator owned book like Shudder, there's no one telling Layla and I what to do, or like, we got to worry about this TV show or this, that, or the thing, you know, or like, and this is not a negative. It's just an observation. It seems like the success of Hawkeye has pushed a lot of books at Marvel to try to go into a Hawkeye kind of direction.
Yep.
And looking back, I think that's might have what they wanted. And I don't know how. I don't think we're very successful at doing that. You know, with sure. like more street level, more this is what they're doing when they're not superheroes, which is fine. I mean, you know, I'm really behind on reading anything basically. But I hear, you know, people like She-Hulk and stuff. So
we've had this conversation about a lot of Marvel books recently, with observations about various levels of success, just like you pointed out, including with where Hawkeye is these days.
Yeah.
So it's interesting with some hindsight to look back at those kind of broad strokes across editorial that probably have major influences from this stemming from this one book. And you know, hindsight is in fact everything. Can we talk a little bit about your transition from editing and writing? Cause we've spoken to other creators who made that jump. And in every case that I can think of, it isn't really much of a leap since the writing was always happening. It was just about finding the opportunity. So in your case, what did your experience editing and actually being in other roles on the production side, how did that instill in you a respect for the integrity of the artist's vision? You've spoken out about that, and I want to hear what you think about the right balance between editorial influence and creator freedom.
Yeah, I think I know what you're referring to. It's funny because, like, you know, people I've been referred to as like, former editor, whatever, blah blah blah. And the thing is, I didn't really do a ton. I put together those Popgun books with, but then even then, it was like me and DJ Kirkbride and Mark and Adam P. Nave and Anthony Wu. So it wasn't like a, you know, and I was never like Image doesn't have on staff editors, you know. So that was all stuff I did on the side, or I edited a couple books once I went freelance, like. Some stuff for Frank Cho and a couple other things. But, you know, I think it depends on what the project entails. You know, I think what you're referring to in specific is the work I did with on the Vertigo anthology, which I think is so overblown in terms of how it's been reported. Because my thing was like, hey, this is billed as something I wrote, and it's not. So there you go. Do whatever. It's still really good. Check it out. The anthology's awesome. And then it got reported as like Joe Keating criticizes Vertigo and stands up for creators' rights. I was like, what? Like, shut up. You know what I mean?
I think the reason why that gets influenced is because there is sort of this, you know, it's not a culture of silence because that makes it sound way too sinister, but it goes back to like Morbius or something like that, where yes, you're the writer, but obviously you are writing under guidelines from editorial.
Well, of course you are, though. I mean, that's the job. If you don't want to do that, get another fucking job. You know what I mean? Like, when you're working at a Marvel Comics and they're hiring you, they're hiring you to, let's just use my experience on Morbius. They're not hiring. They're like, hey, this guy has written comics we enjoy. We have a character we think he would do well on. Let's have him write this, and this is what we need out of this character. That's the job. Okay. If you want to do stuff where you have full control over it or whatever, do a creator-owned comic. You know what I mean? And that's the thing that drives me nuts. Like, that's like, you know, there's lines and stuff I've done for Marvel and DC that I'm entirely my own. But it's like, that's, you know, the reason I never mentioned it is it was never billed as an original work by me. And if I want to do original work, if I want to do stuff that's wholly, well, not wholly my own, because that's ridiculous, because you have your collaborators and your partners and stuff like that. And it's, you know, but the stuff that you come up together, then you do a creator-owned thing. You know, if you're expecting, you know, there's going to be editorial notes and whatever and anything you do, but again, that's the job, you know.
Sure.
And if you don't want to do it, I mean, that's and also the thing that is something new is ridiculous. I mean, you know, comics in the 30s and 40s were being made in you know, these studio spaces in some you know shithole in the middle of Manhattan at a time when Manhattan was a you know not what it is now, not Disneyland it is now, and people were just churning out stuff because that's what the market wanted, you know. And that's the thing. I don't know. I just get driven nuts by the way some people talk about this stuff.
Well, because I think as readers,
sure,
people don't
care, or, you know, not many people do the research or care to learn about how the back end works. They see somebody's name on a book. They assume it's your vision, your writing for that character. They don't really understand the influences that go into.
That means you get all the credit and all the blame.
Oh, well, tell me about it. But I mean, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I've had a great time mostly at Marvel, you know, DC, you know, I mean, even the Vertigo thing, I think, you know, my editor, Mark Doyle, he's a fine human being. Will Dennis, who really had a poor reaction to it, is a great guy. I've met him in person multiple times, and I think they have their hearts in the right place in terms of comics they want to make. I think Mark made a really bad call, and it was a really minor, dumb thing. Just like my ending was totally different. There's dialogue rewritten. Other than that, it's like, who cares? You know?
I think the reason is because those Vertigo anthologies are billed as a creator works, you know. It's not part of the DC universe or anything like that.
Sure.
I think it was a fair thing for you to say, hey, this isn't my original script as I turned it in.
Sure.
And it doesn't mean that you're vilifying, you know, DC or Vertigo or something like that, but it's a good thing to point out. Unfortunately, once you release something into the wild, then
the spin machine
turns on and it gets converted into whatever they want.
I read about it on Bleeding Cool, and it was amazing how I was an ex-Marvel staffer, according to this. My name was spelled three different ways, which was cool.
And also
mentioned that I deleted all my tweets, which was not the case because they linked to them. But, I mean, you never know how things are going to get reported. And I don't know. Like comics, this thing that you know, whatever, it's in the wide scope of planet Earth doesn't matter at all. But to me, it's everything, you know.
Well, and it matters this to thing, of sure. Who are into them? It's fine. Give you permission.
Sure, but you know, I really, this stuff means a lot to me.
Mm-hmm. For your own.
Yeah, and you know, when you have a work that's supposed to be your own and it's not. Whatever. I just feel you got. I mean, like, you know, this sounds like PR, but bullshit. But it's true. You know, readers are why I'm able to have this living. Mm-hmm. Like, if people didn't generously support what I do, especially the original work, the creator owned stuff, there's no living. There's nothing. I'm dead. So I feel I owe it to them to let you know, y'all know that, hey, this is the situation with this or whatever. You know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. Whatever. I feel like I'm gone in a million different directions. I don't even know if I answered your question.
No. It wasn't even. I'm not trying to paint you in the corner about that specific situation either.
Whatever.
I think in a
we got you.
In a bigger sense, that you do have multiple roles when you're working on. I mean, like, do you and Layla have an editor that you guys work with at all for Shudder?
No, but I'm thinking about it. Because I guess to get back to the original thing about the past experience versus the current experience, and why I went on that tangent was, like, I really don't have a lot of editorial experience beyond putting together anthologies. That was kind of my main go-to, and, you know, and on Pop Gun, it was just, like, find the people that we were excited by and just, like, just do whatever, you know, whatever. And, you know, I frankly didn't really know what we were doing, but it worked out pretty well, I think. People seem to like them.
Pretty solid examples in all of those.
So, I mean, I don't know what it's like for, I guess, you know, geez, I don't know.
Well, I mean, if anything you can take from this is the Bleeding Cool headline will be Joe Keating doesn't care about editors.
Right.
Oh, good Lord.
No, it'll be fine because your name will be spelled wrong, so nobody will be able to link it back to you.
I mean, you know, the thing is, what that experience gave me was the appreciation for how damn hard people behind the scenes work, and they just never get any credit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not just editorial. I mean, editors do work their asses off. I remember when we were putting together these What If Age of Ultron things, John Moisen, who was putting it together, the editor, I mean, he was, I'd get emails from him, you know, 10 p.m. New York time on Fridays. The guy was busting ass. So what my time at Image gave me, and again, my primary role there wasn't as an editor. That was more like, I mean, geez, all sorts of other stuff.
Right.
But was seeing the people in production, the people in marketing, the people in the publisher and the accounting and just all this stuff. And, you know, that these are, you know, these are real people putting in a lot of time that never gets acknowledged and are busting ass. And I think the thing that I've taken for that is you know, well, I mean, being knowledgeable about that and being aware that, you know, if you're running late, you're really fucking with people's lives in a way. Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a great lesson.
And also just like Tom Brevoort had a post recently. I forget what it was. I think someone was trying to dramatize something that was happening at Marvel Retreat. I don't remember or really even care. But he had a really good post about how there seems to be a segment of readership that likes to or really desires to put people behind the scenes on like these collectible cards of their mind in terms of like this person's a hero and this person's a villain and whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's just so ridiculous. You know, I mean, these are all these real people that, you know, for the most part, I think are really trying hard to put out comics or passionate about whether you like them or not. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I think that's the thing that I've taken from my experiences more than anything else. Is that that these are very real people behind the scenes, and you know, I don't think, you know, I obviously disagreed with my editors in terms of the Vertigo thing, but I don't begrudge them or dislike them or whatever. They made a call I didn't agree with, and that's it. You know, who cares? You just move on. You know, do the mm-hmm. next thing. You know, do better next time or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think it's common practice there to like I had the weekend after that all happened, I was at Free Comic Day, and a creator I was talking to had a story in an upcoming edition. I don't remember which one of the CMYK anthologies, and they were like, "Oh, is my story going to get it?" I was like, "I don't know, probably not." I think it was a one-time bad call. Unfortunately, I have my thing, and well, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, end of the day, that story looks awesome. Ken Garing killed it.
Yeah,
you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and I'm honored to be partnered with him, and I'm honored that it'd be alongside of people like Amy Chu and Fabio Moon and, you know, all sorts of amazing people in anthology. Right. So, you know, whatever. that's my point of view on all that.
No, I think that's good because it's important to hear that creative process and to understand as a reader that even if, you know, you see three names on a cover, it's really the 20 names plus 100 people more. But, you know, when you're talking about a licensed property of how this came together.
Well, even like, okay, so I've got a copy of Shudder 2 here. And I guess if you've seen Shudder 1, you know, on the cover, the front cover says, you know, our name. So, you know, me and Layla and Owen and Ed. Mm-hmm. But if you flip on the back, it's where we have the masthead for the image. There's like 25 people in here or something,
right.
You know. And each one of those are I mean, I visited the image office post working there, and I can tell you to this day they're working harder than ever to get that stuff out, and it's applicable to Marvel, DC, IDW, Archie, Dark Horse, whatever. You know?
Yeah, right. So, well, can we talk back? Yeah, can we talk a little bit more
I don't know, about can that? We?
We'll try. If I can get this out, we'll try to talk about it. The time at Image, you know, that your early days working at Image in your 20s. I kind of want to hear about that from the now perspective of working with your idols, you know,
right.
And does it still, and if it still happens today, like, is there that a point where the surreal kind of, oh, I'm working with Robert Kirkman or I'm working with Rob Liefeld or something like that?
I mean, Robert's a buddy. It's just funny to hear. I'm the thing about like Robert, I've known him for like 10 years. So it's like when I met him,
yeah, I guess he would have been starting out. So
yeah, we were on the Savage Dragon forums. So it was that's the guy I think of. I don't think of, you know, man, I do love Walking Dead and Invincible right now. I mean, I have for a while, but I mean, I always think of him as that guy.
Were any of these Image guys ever kind of more than you know, bigger than life?
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, a lot of people were for sure. I mean, you know, the way I. You know, I read comics my whole life. I don't remember what my first comics are. No one in my family does either. I think they were probably the stuff that was packaged with toys at the time in the 80s, but I have no clue. I was like, there's pictures of me 2 years old with X-Men comics. You know, who knows how they got there?
Uh-huh.
But the comics that inspired me to make the transition from thinking of like, I want to read these forever, I want to work on these forever, were Image comics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for my, you know, from age 10 to, you know, through my 20s, Savage Dragon was my favorite comic month in, month out.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you start working with people, you know, it does take a little of the magic away, but with the cool thing is that you realize like we were talking about before, these are all just regular people.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so.
Yeah.
So does that ever happen? Is there anybody you meet or have, you know, meet these days that it's still that there's that starstruck?
It's very rare, but I think the last time it happened was when I met Mobius.
Okay. That's fair.
Yeah. Because, you know, I've been very lucky to have a career where I do get to work with people. Like, I mean, I've worked with Eric Larson, I think the majority of the time, but then I got to, you know, work with all the Image guys and whatever. And, you know, and then, you know, meet people in comics or, you know, but with Mobius, it was, it's a kind of a long story, but, you know, he's pretty much my favorite artist in any medium of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got to meet him, I met him twice, and each time I could barely talk.
Hmm.
When, you know, I'd go to any other convention, meet anybody else, and I was like, you know, fine, that's cool. but since meeting him, it's kind of hard for anyone to really intimidate me the way that he intimidated me.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, he was like the kindest, warmest, coolest, you know, welcoming guy, and it was like, you know.
So did that help? Does that help form your, because there's the social aspect of comics too. You know, you're talking about it's con season and traveling around and meeting all these people. And as your name gets bigger and bigger, there's going to be a generation of kids who, you know, maybe they pick up Shudder or they read, you know, Age of Ultron or something like that. And then you're the, you know, you're the Chris Claremont to their generation.
Oof,
that's what all I'm saying. You know? but you know what I mean. There's this. It's not a responsibility, but there is this social interaction aspect to meeting the people whose work influences and shapes you, and sure. Comics especially, because it's a smaller, you know, it's a smaller community, and I think comics are so powerful, especially for younger people,
mm-hmm.
that I think that interaction when they meet you. Makes it can make or break, you know, someone's love of comics.
Are you telling him to not be a dick? Like I'm trying to figure out what you mean.
Fair, I'm saying,
fair enough.
No, I'm well, yes, but it's also how much of that do you have to keep in mind? I mean, I don't know. You know, I like meeting George Perez for me. Like George Perez was the kindest person I've ever met. You know, in that 5 minutes, it's like, and he did it with person after person in line. And like having somebody who was, you know, such an influential comics creator and having that interaction makes a huge difference to me and the community too. But it seems like it's hard to keep up.
Sure. I mean, for me, I don't know, like I it's hard for me to view like this person is a fan or this person a reader. I just, whenever I go to these things, I'm like, these people are stoked for comics. I'm stoked for comics. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about comics. It's very easy for me to kind of get into that. You know, I think that, I don't know. I don't have that element of ego when it's like, oh, these are readers or my stuff or whatever. There's other people who are in stoked about comics, you know?
Right.
And that's why I love going to cons and stuff, yeah. You know, especially like stuff like Emerald City or whatever that's so comics focused. Or like Layla and I just did a signing at Baltimore, Maryland's Collector's Corner.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I've signed at the store twice now, and I've done one of their conventions. The reason I've been going there so much is just because every time I leave, I'm just stoked because they cultivate this community of people who are like just extremely excited about comics in general. And, you know, thankfully, we're very grateful they're excited about our comics, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only like that's a minor element for me in terms of the greater thing for me is just talking with a bunch of people who are, you know, in love with the same medium that we are. So
I think that's a perfectly good answer, and it's that maybe it is the lack of ego that keeps people, you know, grounded. Like the best interactions are the people that don't treat people like fans, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
It's another person who's into comics.
Well, I was at New York Comic Con last year, and I saw this line that I was like, it was so huge, and I was like, oh, that's probably the Kirkman Charlie Adler line, because I knew they were signing together. And I looked and I saw, and it was Kelly Sue DeConnick. And, you know, I've been convinced even before that, but really reinforced then that she's either A, the biggest name in comics right now, or B, will be within the next year and a half,
mm-hmm.
2 years. And, you know, the thing about her is that, you know, she should have a massive ego. She's extremely talented and she's extremely successful, but she's also the kindest, one of the kindest people I've met since working in comics, you know, for the last 10 whatever years. And she really does seem to take that to the way she interacts with her readership and, you know, includes them in on it. I've never seen someone be so welcoming to the people who are in it and make them feel like they're invested in on it together. It's really cool. And people like her really inspire me in terms of how, you know, I mean, whatever. I don't, you know, think of what I do is anything special. So I'm just, again, you know, when I go to these cons, I'm just really looking forward to talking with people. But yeah, people like Kelly Sue, man, they're the ones who make comics look great. You know,
a good face for the industry.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah,
that was true in Seattle too. I mean, she was over, like catty corner from where you and Layla were. But I'm sure that you wandered around and saw that whole where she and Matt and Chip were was like mobbed the entire weekend.
Yeah, you know, it's actually Matt and Chip are another good example, because I was talking to a buddy of mine about just the way, like, they act at shows. And the thing about what we both agreed on with Matt and Chip is that I've never seen two people seem to have such a good time just hanging out and then thus making the people who read Sex Criminals feel like they're part of this, I guess, party or whatever, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's cool. It's nice. It's inspiring. You know, I think the thing I like about comics is that most people involved are you know, doing it because they love comics, and, you know, they love sharing that with this really group, you know, thankfully growing and rabid readership. It's fun.
So I feel bad, because I feel like now my next question is going to be sort of a downer, and I don't mean it like that.
Okay.
But I think just broadly, do you have any regrets? Because we probably all would want to redo aspects of our 20s, sometimes significantly. But in your case, you had access to top talent in the industry to learn from. And I think that shows in what you're doing now. But I'm sure that there are some things that you maybe, I don't know, maybe I'm not sure. Is there anything you wish that you would have done differently along the path to get to where you are?
It's funny. I was talking to my stepmom today. We're talking about how, like, I was joking, but I don't really mean this, but how people just in our family kind of seem to be shitheads from like 12 to 26, you know, and how sometimes
not just your family, man.
So, you know, I don't know. So nothing in terms of like stuff that I would regret, but, you know, maybe there are times in my life where I haven't been as you know, whatever. I mean, who knows? I don't regret anything, just because everything that you go through and every experience you have and everything that you've ever done leads you to where you're at now in your life and where you're going next. And I'm extremely grateful to be where I feel very lucky to be where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, for the most part, I'm at a place, and I should knock on wood as I say this, but, you know, can work on pretty much whatever I want with, you know, and the partners I have that I'm collaborating with. I guess got pages from issue 6 from Layla last night, and I was just like, I can't believe she wants to work with me. Like, she can work with anybody. She's so freaking talented, you know? So anything that I've done in the past or whatever, I mean, I don't know. Gosh, do you guys remember, there was a year or two ago, Twitter did this thing where you could, like, download your Twitter feed and just, like, read it. Oh, man, I made it, like, 2 minutes in. I was like, God, it was so annoying at 26. I was just like, oh, good Lord. I should not have been on Twitter back then. But, but, you know, again, everything leads to you to a different place. And so, no regrets. And there's things that, like, everything's been a lesson. I mean, even the more recent stuff, the stuff that I've worked on that maybe has not worked out so great or whatever, I don't begrudge or hate any of it, just because everything teaches you something if you're paying attention. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, you sound really grounded about it. Maybe you wouldn't have answered the same way at 26, but I think that now it's a good response, right? Like, everybody hates themselves when they go back and look at what they said in their 20s.
Y'all sure.
Just need to simmer down. But but it sounds like you have You have a very kind of healthy separation.
Now, this really is called comics therapy. Good Lord.
Dude, I told you. It was. You got the warning ahead of time that it wasn't going to be. Yeah. It's cathartic. Yeah.
Okay, one more serious question.
All right. What do you got?
You got a little bit of energy and spirit left in you. This will break you, and then we can give you a little bit of a reprieve. So
sure.
So you know, to go back to that, the Twitter thing and social media, you know, there's a good and bad aspect of it. No, maybe I've pumped this up.
I have here the transcript from 19 or whatever.
So we're gonna go back to the Savage Dragon forums and something you said in 1998. No, I'm just kidding. But you can find out a lot about a creator's life these days, and you know, kind of anyone who follows you can see the books and movies that you're ingesting. This is sort of goes to the creative process, though. Like, do you find yourself riding the line between inspiration and imitation sometimes when you're creating new work? And I mean, I guess my question is, how do you make sure you aren't aping something you're really into and just using these influences kind of in new ways?
I mean, gosh, that's a convoluted question. I don't know.
Sorry.
I mean, you just got to be conscious of it, I guess. You know what I mean? Like, and look through stuff. I don't think there's anything I've done that was me aping anything.
No, and I'm not implying that at all. But I think I've seen, like, for me, I think I really saw it come out in the Hulk miniseries. Because like a year up leading up to that, you were in France, you were reading, like, you know, there was a lot of French work that you were especially ingesting probably when you were writing that. And it doesn't, not I'm not at all saying that it was somehow regurgitating anything.
Oh, well,
but I can
see
the influence for sure.
Sure. Well, influence is separate. I mean, you know, I mean, France, I mean, this is going to sound so hoity-toity and dumb, but France has really changed my life. Like I was working at Image Staff, and I just saved up money because I really wanted to go on my own as opposed to being part of like a convention, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to go to the Angoulême Festival and just to go and to meet Mobius and to, you know, whatever, just exposed to all the different stuff. And on that trip, it was a huge, I mean, life altering thing, both professionally and personally, in terms of realizing what I wanted to do. And like, for instance, I think the better example is Glory, because that was really, that book is really about this, I mean, at least in terms of the personal aspect of it, I mean, amongst other things, but thinking where my life like was going to go, and then having this jolt of where I really wanted it to go, and mm-hmm. then doing everything I, you know, you can to get there. You know,
yeah.
Which, gosh, and again, sounds so dumb and hoity-toity coming out, but
no. Why on earth would you like reduce that experience?
Yeah, that's a very valid, and yeah. I think anyone would give you that. That sounds like a life-altering experience, and to get you to, you know, where you have to reflect on where you've been and where you want to go.
When I went there, I didn't speak the language and I only knew a few people. So it was kind of, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing at all.
Mm-hmm.
The Hulk is kind of less so. It really is more Glory, because the Hulk is just like, I mean, I've been into this stuff my whole life too. I mean, my dad really got me into, I guess, what's commonly in the Criterion Collection now, you know, a bunch of old French movies and European cinema in general. And then just a personal fascination with European history from like the 1800s till about 1945 has kind of been there my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's, I mean, with Hulk, it was just like, Hulk seems to be the most, one of the most American ideas I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
Now in terms of like, I mean, if Captain America is the positive view on it, Hulk is sort of this negative, you know, Captain America's victory at Normandy and Hulk is more of our, you know, bombing Nagasaki.
Sure.
So
okay.
Kind of the personification of this shame and this id of America. So my thing was just like, well, I think it'd be kind of cool to put him in the least American place I could possibly could and see what happens when you filter through it. So that was less so that. But I mean, I don't know.
What are you watching right now?
You know, I've been so, I mean, I always watch that. I'm a huge movie nerd. I've been so slammed that I've been really behind on stuff, but I paid to go see Jodorowsky's Dune about four times. which is, you know, at a time when, like, I still haven't seen the new Miyazaki, and he's one of my favorite directors. you know, I still haven't seen Her, which is ridiculous. I should have seen that months ago. So, you know, but with Jodorowsky's Dune, I think it really hit me at a really important time in my life. It's a story I already knew because it's basically about Jodorowsky's 1976 attempt to create a movie based off, well, very loosely based off of Frank Herbert's Dune.
Right.
And it was, you know, he was collaborating with Mobius, that name again, Dan O'Bannon, you know, Chris Foss, H.R. Geiger, and, you know, a whole bunch of people. Orson Welles was going to be in it. Salvador Dali was supposed to be in it. and it was this monumental task that ultimately failed. And it's really inspiring. I mean, that's kind of interesting to see, but it's really inspiring to, like, what it talks about in terms of the creative pursuit and then where you go when things don't work out the way you want to and where you go next. And in this case in specific, what they ended up doing was creating a bunch of comics that they, you know, controlled and owned, and, you know, like that kind of stuff, with, like, Meta Barons and Incal, and later on Techno Priest and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, it just, like, it really hit me at just the right time. And so I've been kind of on a Jodorowsky kick, which is, I mean, he's someone I've liked for a long time, but, you know, just on my mind. But I've been doing so much traveling for Shudder in specific that it's really been hard for me to, you know, watch much, which is, you know, I don't know, what have I seen lately? Man, yeah, it's been really, I'm really behind. And I watched so many TV shows. Game of Thrones is awesome.
Okay.
I watch Louie, Mad Men. But even then, it's like, eh, I don't really keep up.
They're always there.
Is it more of like an opportunity to decompress, you know, on a plane or something? Or
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't have it, like, you know, scheduled out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Game of Thrones I always keep up on. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
Did you read the books?
No, I was going to, and then I'm just not convinced they're ever going to get finished. So I'm just going to watch the TV show. But I do read I read a ton of, you know, not comic stuff. I read a lot of history stuff. I read a lot of, I don't know, man, I ever since I was a kid, I've really loved reading in specific and any whatever form that comes, whether it's comics, novels, nonfiction, newspapers, I mean, whatever, really. So just a lot of stuff.
Back of the shampoo bottle. I guess.
Back of the shampoo bottle, macaroni boxes, you know, whatever.
Cool.
You find inspiration anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the kind of thing, you know, if you don't live your life and you don't, you know, let yourself be inspired by the things in it or what, I mean, it is conversely, it's like if you only ever, I think that's part of it. I think that's what it is, to kind of get back to your question now that we've kind of gone through it. I think if you only ever, like, people are like, oh, I want to write Superman. You know, what should I do? It's like, well, don't read a bunch of Superman comics.
Mm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Draw what you can from your own life. Or, and if you want to, and if you read something, you know, read mythology or read, you know, I don't know, someone's real life struggle against all insane odds or whatever. You know, I think that's the thing. You ape things if you have nothing else, if you don't bring anything personal to it. You know, I think if you bring a personal edge to whatever you've ingested and, you know, life experience with it. I mean, a lot of, I mean, Shudder is by far the most personal thing I've ever done. And I don't know that it's ever going to be evident, nor do I really frankly wish to talk about it, but it's the most personal thing I've ever worked on. And I said that when I did Glory, and I said that when I did Hell Yeah, and I said that when I've done other things, and it just exponentially every time, it just seems like, you know, if you bring, like, you know, I really have this thing to bring, not just my own life, but the life that you know, now you kind of share with your collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I do take a really strong standpoint against people who view artists as, you know, these people just drawing their stories. I really have no interest in that. I really just want to work on things together. And so with Shudder, you know, there's stuff in Layla's own life that's brought into it. And I don't mean like A to A. Like, I don't mean there's like, oh, this is this experience that I had. Now it's an adventure story. But it's more so like the stuff we've emotionally been through or whatever, you know.
Right.
And so that's what takes it from like, oh, we're just doing our take on Tintin or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
Whatever. So I don't know. I guess that's, I think that if you have to let yourself be sort of vulnerable in a sense to the story and thus your reader, And if you're not willing to let yourself, I mean, the stuff I've worked on that I haven't been happy with, and I don't really feel the need to get into to what or why, but is the stuff that hasn't had enough of that, and that's my failure there, not someone else's. So anyway, mm-hmm. I don't know. Put yourself into your work, like it's your own personal home videos, and be embarrassed by what you do, you know.
So, yeah, yeah, that's great. Okay, yeah. Well, here's a fun question then.
All right,
and kind of, and it kind of goes to that answer too. So. What cool stuff have you gotten recently?
Oh man, dude. So I guess this is out next week.
Yes.
I'm doing a thing for this Comics and Cola website, which is really awesome. I really suggest you check it out. I think the website is just comicsandcola.com. I'm going to double check though.
Okay. And we'll link to it on the website.
Yeah. Comicsandcola.com, all one word. They're doing a thing called Comic Shelfie, and I'm actually just earlier today I've been taking pictures of my collection.
Mm-hmm.
And they like they want you to take like some overall pictures of your collection, which I've done. But then they're like, choose one thing to do. And I was like, I'll do a couple pictures of my Mobius collection, see like what's in there. And it's just like this insane. Like I didn't like it was taking me way too long, and like my dog wanted to go outside and stuff. And he was like, oh, what are you doing? And I was like, I got into this Mobius collection, man. I gotta deal with it. It's gonna take four. It's gonna take a while. In terms of recent stuff, I don't know. I got a run of Sanctuary, which is this manga. It's really good. I got a run of The Thing somewhat recently, the Thing series from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I got random shit. Like I was at Collector's Corner, and they're awesome to me. Like they let me raid their dollar bins, and I grabbed some Arthur Adams X-Men annuals, and then Layla was super into them, so I was like, you just take them, you know, whatever. And then I got, I don't even know. I'd have to look into it. It was just random 80s and 90s comics, basically. And then, you know.
Do you have an inventory of your collection, Joe?
No, it's a mess. I think that if Aaron sees my collection, he'll start crying because, like, I'm not a guy who keeps things very well organized, nor, like, I don't ever intend to sell these things off, so I don't really care. Like, whenever I purge my collection, I donate them, so I don't, you know.
I brought him a box of non-bagged, non-boarded comics in a cardboard box that, like, just hung out in the trunk of my car. And he still talks to me, so I think you're probably fine.
Yeah, all right. A picture I took of my to-read pile, it'll probably make you just start, quit this interview, because it's just like this pile of comics, and they're not bad, they're not boarded, they're like kind of crumpling each other. But I don't know, like, I remember one time when...
See, to me, look, I don't begrudge people not, like, I understand for some reason, I don't really understand it, but I understand in theory that
you don't understand it.
You would not bag and board your comics, but like, even to give away, wouldn't you want to give something that's still readable away? They just get destroyed otherwise.
I don't know. I just sent you a picture over Skype. I don't know if you can get it.
Yeah, it's coming, I think.
I don't know. I mean, I remember one time when, when we announced the Extreme line, we did this preview book, and I gave one to my buddy Ricky Purden, who now works over at DC.
Oh, yeah, I'm looking at the picture. That is that's painful.
And,
wait. Is it worse than me?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. He took the preview book I gave him, and I saw him later that night. He was like, oh, man, I've been showing everyone this preview book. I'm really stoked. And
I just opened the picture.
Oh, nice. Yeah, he had the preview book rolled in his back pocket. And he's like, oh, I hope you don't mind me mangling it. I was like, no, man, that's how comics should be. Like, you should just, like...
Well, preview book's fine.
Well, whatever. I love it. I like the idea of my comics all being rolled up in someone's back pocket. That sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hate, like... I mean, like, if people want to CGC their stuff, that's fine. Like, it's not a thing I understand. But... Unless it's like Action Comics number one or something that like just doesn't exist anymore,
mm-hmm.
and needs to be preserved. But like I don't know. I mean, I
do you read anything digitally?
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, I mean, I was this Comixology thing has kind of complicated things for me.
Yeah.
I don't really understand. I mean, I understand, and I don't why they did what they did in terms of, you know, I can't purchase things in app anymore. But like I was on the train the other day, and I was reading an article about the end of Peter David's Hulk run, and I was like, oh man, I would love to read that right now. So I'm on my phone, I'm like, I'm gonna download on Comixology, and then my app was like, nope. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay. So I think that might have tapered down for me a bit, but I think what interests me about comics in general, including digital, is the idea that it's this medium that can exist all these different formats. one thing you'll see when this Comics and Cola thing goes up is that I have stuff all over the place. I have tons of single issues. I have tons of trades, hardcovers, weird, you know, artist edition size stuff. When I have, you know, a bunch of digital comics, like stuff I really love, like, for instance, Casanova by Father Moon, Gearba, and Matt Fraction. Like, mm-hmm. I have that. I have that in single issues. I have that in trades. I have that in a hardcover. I've got that in, you know, digitally, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I just think it's interesting how, you know, I don't know. Yeah, I'm kind of all over the place in terms of what I read. I just like comics, period, you know, whether they're in a single issue or a newspaper or whatever. Whatever the format works for the story best.
Hmm.
In art, you know.
Are you judging, Aaron?
I'm just taking a minute to collect myself here. It's fine. People who make comics get a pass. If you're just a really? Fan like me.
Oh, just a fan. I hate that. Come on.
If you're a fan like me, then you have to preserve your artifacts. That's my feeling.
Oh, jeez.
They don't have to be graded, but they have to be.
So you're not judging Joe. You're judging me. Yes. That's what it always comes back to.
That's unfair. You shouldn't do that. Come on.
That's how our relationship works.
Uh-huh.
All right. That's fine. That's fair. We don't have to talk about which slab CGC 9.8 comics. You know, you've gotten back from.
All right, Aaron. I'll make you cry.
Mm.
So I was buying Walking Dead from issue number one,
uh-huh.
And I had a complete run. And a buddy of mine, when I went freelance, gave me one of my first jobs, and he really always wanted that. So I was like, I'll just take it. He's like, what? I was like, I don't know, whatever, just take it. I don't give a shit. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And he was, you know, gave him, like, I think it probably graded at 9.8.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever. And it was loose, and it was not even in a bag or anything.
No, but that kind of thing, it's like, yeah, I understand that, yeah. And you might not care. But at the same time, like, I mean, there's a reality to, I mean, this now people are going to be bored because this isn't really about comics.
Oh, I'm cutting all of this out, honey. Don't worry.
This is about collecting comics. But there is a monetary value to that. Like now, that's a $4,000 comic, you know, on the market. Like,
I just don't think of it that way. I just want people to read these things. I don't give a shit about selling these things off. You know, I've got like, I mean, you know, whatever. That's like, I don't do these because I have no interest in my stuff being sealed up in a slab. I mean, if people want to do that, it's fine. I want people to read these things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so depressing if you're calm. I mean, and if it's what you want to do and it's what makes you happy in life, then do it. Who cares what I think? But for me, the idea of making my comics unreadable, you know, beyond the quality of the writing, I just mean in terms of like, you know, how they're preserved.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What's the fucking point? You know what I mean?
Is there a collect? Go ahead.
No. I get to ask this question. You collect. I've never heard this viewpoint before. You collect runs of things to read them.
Yes.
That without necessarily getting sucked into then preserving them as an artifact.
No, not really. No.
That's awesome.
I just want to read comics. I don't give a shit.
Okay. Great. You know? I'm done. I got nothing.
Yeah, I mean, like, I when I buy these things, I'm not like, I just want to read the thing, see what was happening with Rocky Grimm Space Ranger back in the 80s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't care if I'm going to slab it later or whatever. I mean, like, I have this really, I mean, certain things I have, like, one of the most important comics ever published was this comic called Mickey Mouse and the Air Pirates. It's a really, really important underground comics back in the day.
Hmm.
And I'll send you the cover of that too, and I think it'll kind of better illustrate what it is. But I'll describe it as I do this, so it's not totally boring for people listening to the podcast. The reason why it was so important, it was done, you know, in the underground era. So I want to say the late '60s, maybe early '70s, and it was Dan O'Neill headlined it, or not headlined it, but you know, kind of was in charge of it. And it was a parody of Disney comics. And if you look at the cover,
mm-hmm.
It's Mickey Mouse smuggling dope on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, the interiors are, you know, including other comics, but, you know, these unauthorized Disney comics by underground cartoonists that mm-hmm. were, you know, lewd and whatever. And it was... actually, I mean, I'm sure that there's a book that I think called just the Air Pirates. I could be wrong. Mickey and the Pirates, something like that, that gets into more of the history of it. But in terms of parody law and just independent comics and the underground scene, you know, it was extremely, it was a huge piece of history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I spent a decent amount of money on it, but I bought it not to like preserve, but just because I wanted to have this thing that was so important to, you know, what's become my livelihood. And plus it's mm-hmm. entertaining to see Mickey Mouse smuggle dope and, you know, do all sorts of stuff.
But you're not, you didn't read it and then just throw it in a pile. I mean, you know.
No, if you see it, I've got a spinner rack. It's just sitting in the spinner rack.
Like, that's at your house in that picture?
That's at my house, yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's worth hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, like, to me, there, it's fine. I wish I didn't feel the need to preserve all these artifacts around me, but I mean, that goes to my own kind of whatever, you know, mental health issues.
Well, here's my perspective on this, right? And this is kind of like, if you, I've been saying this a lot in interviews lately, so maybe it's another therapy thing, but I've had some friends pass away recently, and I've had some stuff happen, and it really made me realize the importance of, like, that you're just gonna die. Like, that's the only thing you can guarantee, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's the point if you want to appreciate these things in your life to keep them sealed while you're still alive? And what's supposed to happen? I mean, someone sells it after you're dead, I guess. I don't freaking know. But I'd rather be able to experience these things and enjoy these things and have my life, you know, be however affected by these things in a positive and negative way than seal it off and keep it away from anyone. And, you know, I won't lend it out because it is such a rare thing. But if someone wants to come over and read it, you know, I'd rather they experience that. And maybe they'll be inspired by it, or I don't know, man. Yeah, I feel like I'm overblowing this. But I just rather be able to have these things live on instead of being sealed away. You know, I hate the idea of, like, you know, I mean, all these comics. Ugh. I mean, in different structured folks, you know, I don't think the way I read comics is any better than anyone else reads comics or preserves their comics or whatever. You know, it's anything in life. Everyone has a different path and everyone has a different sort of way things work for them, and, you know, whatever works, whatever, as long as you're not affecting life and liberty of somebody else, you know, who cares?
It is healthier to not be attached to material goods.
Yeah.
I'm not nearly that healthy.
Well, I'm definitely, I'm still buying these things.
Sure.
They still exist in my house.
Yeah.
So, you know, I am not.
You just aren't nice about inviting us over at any point to read them.
Oh, no one's welcome to come over, but, you know. If someone's managed to see that, they're there.
Awesome. Well, thank you again to Joe Keating for joining us on the couch this week. Thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes and other details are on the site, as always, comicstherapy.com. Later, skaters. If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, I'd take back those words that hurt you, and you'd stay. I don't know why I said the things I said. Pride's like a knife, it can cut deep inside. Words are like weapons.